How wealth is distributed in this country has become a central issue in contemporary society and in the political arena. Candidates and commentators are currently debating whether our current system of taxation is the best approach, and the idea of a flat tax is being floated once again. So we thought that we would talk about how our tax system works on this segment to please explain how it came to be the way it is and what effect changes in the system, including the adoption of a flat tax, might have on our economy. And joining us now is Joseph Thorndike, the director of the Tax History Project at Tax Analysts, a nonprofit and nonpartisan provider of tax news and analysis. He's an editor and contributor for Tax Notes magazine and has written about taxes and tax history for a wide variety of publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to our show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We're also taking listener calls at 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment or a question on our show page at WNYC.org. Mr. Thorndike, we usually begin with these Please Explain segments with the beginning. So let's talk a bit about the history of taxation. Do we know when the first taxes were levied?
I think that is lost in the mists of time. I mean, it's pretty safe to say that it's coincident with the rise of government of some form. And, you know, what we call a tax has changed over time. Sometimes, you know, rulers would just take things from people. They would sort of expropriate it, and they'd take stuff rather than cash or some sort of money. And that's a kind of a tax, too. Conscription is a kind of a tax. When you draft someone into the army, you're basically, you know, taking a big chunk of their labor. And so it's reasonable to treat that kind of military service as a tax. So, you know, if you look at it that way, you know, as ways of supporting government, it just stretches way back. And certainly there are, you know, by the time we get into the ancient world of the Greeks and Romans, they're very sophisticated tax collectors. They have people whose job it is to go out and collect taxes, and they assess it in sort of sophisticated ways. So it's thousands of years old, it's safe to say.
King John's taxation in the Robin Hood stories suggests that taxation was often seen as unfair and weighted toward the rich and against the poor.
Well, I mean, you know, this brings to mind what people always say about the United States, and they say, wow, you know, we are a nation of tax resisters. It's just bred into us. It's part of our national culture. And I say, find me the country where people like paying taxes. You know, if there's any constant in the history of taxation, it's that people resent it. And no tax is going to be, you know, totally fair in all circumstances, and many taxes will be quite unfair much of the time. So there are always complaints, and I think that you know, if you look back everywhere where people are collecting taxes, where governments are collecting taxes, there are plenty of people complaining about it. Now, that's not to say that every tax is the same and they're all equally bad. Some are much worse than others. You know, taxing necessities, for instance, the classic example is a salt tax. Is horribly unfair because everybody needs it and it's expensive for, you know, including poor people, and they have to pay for it. So those sorts of taxes are bad. But you know, there are ways around that. So all taxes are unpopular, but some taxes are better or worse than others.
And then there are other factors. Taxation without representation was one of the rationales behind the American Revolution, wasn't it?
It was, and I think, again, that gets back to sort of the inherently unpleasant nature of having the government take money from you. If that's going to go on, and most people recognize that it has to if you're going to have a government, then you want to have some say in it. I mean, it's much easier, ultimately, to collect taxes in a democratic society where people are sort of invested in the government and invested in the ways of supporting it. That's a crucial element in building a functional, good society. Is you give people a stake in the game, and we say, we'll give you a chance here to voice your opinions about how we're going to get this money. And that certainly was the issue in many respects during the Revolution, or at least it was sort of the hot button issue, because people felt like they were not getting a say in how that money was collected, and they were used to it, because up until then, you know, in the United States or in the colonies, the colonists had been in charge of their own taxes most of the time through their local legislatures, and they really resented having somebody sort of parachute in and say, this is how we're going to take the money from you.
In this country, we have different types of taxes: sales tax, property tax, income tax. Do most countries have as many types of taxes as we do?
I think most countries have a diverse collection of taxes, and that's partly because it functions better. Certain taxes are susceptible to revenue changes. In some years they'll raise a lot of money, and in some years they won't raise a lot of money. The income tax is a good example of that. When the economy is in recession or in depression, the income tax raises much less money because people are earning much less money. And then in good years it raises a ton of money. Well, that's great. It balances out over time, but governments actually have to live year to year, so it's nice to have other kinds of taxes in the mix that will have a more steady revenue stream. So, yeah, most countries try to enact a lot of different taxes so that they'll be sure to have money flowing in all the time, regardless of what might be going on in the world.
Although in this country, things vary from state to state. New Hampshire doesn't have an income tax, right? And Oregon has no sales tax?
Right. The states have chosen their own paths, as is their privilege under our federal government, in how they want to fund their own operations. And lots of states don't have income taxes, and lots don't have sales taxes, and some rely very heavily on property taxes. Each one of these, of course, has its, passionate opponents. Very few taxes have passionate supporters, but each of these has a constituency of people who just hate it. But it works for that state. They sort of develop a tradition around it. They get used to the taxes that they have, and they don't really want to bring in new ones. It's really painful for states in general when they try to introduce a new tax for a state that doesn't have an income tax to suddenly start collecting one. It tends to be a pretty rough transition for them.
My guest is Joseph Thorndike, director of the Tax History Project at Tax Analysts, a nonprofit, nonpartisan provider of tax news and analysis. He's also an editor and contributor for Tax Notes magazine. Bet you didn't know those publications were out there. We're taking your calls at 646-829-3985. You can also leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So let's talk about the flat tax. Currently in the lead-up to the presidential election, our system of taxation is being debated, and the idea of a flat tax has been proposed by Herman Cain and Rick Perry, and some of the other candidates are hinting at similar plans. Before we get into the debate over the flat tax, let's just take a moment to take a look at what its proponents want to replace. How should we describe the type of taxation system we have in the United States? It's called progressive, isn't it?
It is. I mean, again, as we were saying, governments levy a lot of different taxes. Even on the federal level, we have a bunch of different taxes. We all think immediately of the individual income tax because lots of us pay it. But, then we have that payroll tax that we pay for Social Security, but we don't file any returns for that. And then we pay a bunch of excise taxes on things like, gas and tobacco and that sort of thing. But the income tax, what we all think of as the tax that we pay, it is progressive in the sense that the rate goes up along with income, which is what's being taxed. And that's pretty much the definition of a progressive tax, when the rate increases with the thing that's being taxed.
But a criticism of the tax system from both left and right is that it isn't fair.
Well, I mean, I think you could find a fair number of people who would say it is fair. It may be horribly complicated, and there are inequities embedded within, its larger fairness.
Well, it becomes more and more complicated. And now people on the Occupy Wall Street side say that the rich are paying less than they should. The rich are now arguing on Fox that 45% of the country doesn't even pay taxes, and so that they are the 55% who do. And it sounds to me like everybody is just canceling everybody out.
Well, it's one of those things. It's that issue about non-payers. The statement is true, and it is also open to being misleading. So it's true that roughly half of Americans don't pay the income tax, but they're paying plenty of other taxes, right? And so
it's not sales tax and things of that sort.
I mean, they're paying payroll taxes, most of them, the Social Security tax, and a lot of other things like the tax on gasoline that I was mentioning. So they're paying plenty of taxes. They're just not paying the income tax. Now, reasonable people can disagree about this. I actually think it's not a bad idea to have more people paying the income tax, even if it's just a token amount, because the income tax is about raising money to support the government. That's for sure. But it's also something broader than that. It's also sort of about citizenship, about participation. These people are clearly participating in the tax system through other less visible forms of taxation. But I do think that there's a credible case to be made that everybody should be part of that sort of annual ritual of filing your taxes. I know it's painful, but I did a piece a couple of years ago called Hurts So Good. And my argument was essentially that pain sort of engages people. You know, it gets them to pay attention to what government is doing, and that's good for everyone. It can still be progressive. These people, you know, if you ask poorer people to pay the income tax, you could ask them to pay just a very small amount. But I think it's not unreasonable to say that they should. Now, that being said, most of this criticism is misleading because it said these people are freeloaders. You know, these people are not paying anything. That's simply not true, and it really distorts the debate in an unfortunate way, I think.
Would everyone have to pay if a flat tax were enacted?
No, everyone would not have to pay under most versions of a flat tax that you see out there. And in fact, lots of flat tax proposals, including the ones that are out there now from the presidential campaigns and the ones that we've seen in the past, like Steve Forbes' proposals from the 90s, these have a big exemption. You know, a family of four, for instance, gets this big exemption. I seem to recall was like $40,000 or $50,000 a year in income wouldn't be taxed, the same way we get exemptions under the income tax right now. Well, what that means, in effect, is that lots and lots of people are not going to be paying this flat tax either. You know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I'd like it that they paid something. But you know, it's reasonable. These people don't have a lot of disposable income. They need the money that they're earning, and to give them an exemption for that, it seems okay. But the flat tax does not, in general, solve that problem of non-payers.
Well, the idea of a system that's simple and more straightforward is appealing. How would a flat tax actually work? You've already told us it's not all that simple after all.
Well, I mean, there are two things about the flat tax that are interesting, I think. One is the flatness, right? The single rate. That's not really an issue of simplification because, you know, the way you calculate the taxes that you owe at the end of the year, you're not going in there and calculating multiple times with multiple rates, certain parts of your income, other parts of your income. You know, you just, if you're still one of the few people doing it all by hand, you figure out what your income is and you look on the tax table and you run over your finger and it says, this is what you owe. They do the math for you. So the multiple rates is not really about simplification. The other thing that's interesting about the flat tax, at least as it's usually proposed, is the base of it, which is to say that the flat tax usually involves getting rid of a lot of these deductions and exemptions and preferences that we have tacked onto the tax system. Now, you know, you said earlier lots of people complain that this system isn't fair, and some of them are no doubt complaining that the progressive rate structure isn't fair. They think a single rate is better, is more fair. Other people are complaining that there's a nice progressive rate structure, but that rich people are still making out like bandits because they use all these tricks and shenanigans to reduce their taxes, and that's true. So, you know, fairness resides in a couple of different places. It resides in the rate schedule. It also resides in what we do to the tax base. And the problem with the income tax, the principal problem with it, is that the tax base gets riddled with loopholes over time.
Well, if you look at, let's say we had a 20% flat tax. If somebody earns $50,000 a year, 20% of that is $10,000. That's a big chunk out of that income. If you earn $1 million, 20% of that is $200,000. You're still left with $800,000. It's not. I don't think the pain is as big. How do the proponents argue? Explain that.
Well, I think that there are differing assumptions that go into that, right? I mean, I'll come clean here. I'm not a supporter of the flat tax. I like the progressive rate structure. I think it serves the interests of fairness. But for plenty of flat tax supporters, and I think it's a reasonable, credible argument, just not one I agree with, they say it's just, you know, what could be more fair than asking everybody to pay the same percentage of their income? You know, there is a sort of gut-level apparent fairness to that that I think is pretty persuasive, and that's why the flat tax tends to poll pretty well initially, because what people like about it, at least this is what it looks like when the scholars have gone in and tried to tease apart the poll data, what people like about it is they think, well, you know what, they're going to get rid of all these special tax loopholes that the rich guys are taking advantage of, and so they might not be paying at these super high rates, but at least we know they're going to be paying something.
Are there any places where there are flat taxes?
Yeah, plenty of places around the world have flat taxes.
How well does it work?
You know, it works reasonably well in a lot of these places. You know, there's no reason a flat tax shouldn't work well if what we mean is that it, you know, people pay their taxes and it raises a certain amount of revenue. The real question in the U.S. context is, will these flat taxes work well? Will they raise enough money? I mean, the Perry flat tax, the Rick Perry's flat tax that he recently proposed, has been, according to most analysts, is not going to raise nearly enough money, and is going to, it implies all sorts of major spending cuts. So, you know, that's a whole, that muddies the waters, right? You know, then you're not just talking about taxes anymore. You're talking about the size of government and social programs and everything else.
Well, his tax is a flat rate of 20%. Herman Cain's is the 999 plan. So Herman Cain sees taxes being raised in other places as well to compensate for the loss of taxes on the federal level?
I suppose that's possible, although that would require a major juggling of governmental responsibilities, too. I mean, you couldn't just transfer things we can no longer afford at the federal level to the state level and think that that's going to be a seamless process. So, I mean, I think, you know, it's more helpful to talk about tax reform in a sort of revenue neutral way. Like, what do you know, if we wanted to raise as much money as we're raising now, but do it in a better way, how would we do that? That's the best way to talk about it. Now, you know, down the road, looking as a fiscal realist, we're going to need to raise a lot more money down the road. So that may get baked right in. But trying to reform the tax system and raise a lot of money at the same time, it doubles your problems. I'm not really sure that those two projects go well hand in hand.
Well, Herman Cain's probably wouldn't go over well in Germany because 999 means no, 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 doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
We're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we'll take some listener calls and look further into the whole concept of flat taxes with Joseph Thorndike, who's director of the Tax History Project at Tax and Analysts, a nonprofit, nonpartisan provider of tax news and analysis. He's also the editor and contributor to Tax Notes magazine. And our number here is 646-829-3985. You can also leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org. We're back with Joseph Thorndike, director of the Tax History Project at Tax Analysts, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan provider of tax news and analysis. We're taking your calls at 646-829-3985. You can also leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org, and we'll get to those questions in a moment. But I just want to address one other thing. Over the past century in this country, the tax rate has been altered dramatically from one generation to the next, with the highest levels in the 1940s when those with the highest incomes were taxed at a rate of 94%, which seems unthinkable now, although the country was going through an economic boom at the time. So 94%, did anybody pay that much?
No one really paid that much because that's just a marginal rate. So that was the rate that they were paying on their last dollar of income. Average rates, which is, you know, when you take all these progressive rate structure and you do all the math and you come up with what are you actually paying as a percentage of your income, that's your average rate. Those are much lower, but they were much higher in the 1940s during World War II than they ever have been before or since.
Well, you know, don't people argue that taxes actually cut down on growth? But that was an incredible growth period. Are people wrong, or were there other factors?
Well, I think it's the other factors. It's taxes do have an effect on growth. I think most economists would agree with that. But it's not the only issue. And the U.S. had a lot going for it, you know, coming out of the war in the 1950s. And so even with high rates, and I mean almost all economists of all political persuasions thought those rates were too high, and that in the 90% range, you're definitely affecting incentives in a way you probably don't want to do. But there was, you know, the U.S. had a lot going for it, and so it did quite well. I think that the take-home lesson from that is not that high taxes are great for growth. I think it's that high taxes are not necessarily an impediment to growth. You know, other things are probably much more important in shaping the economic welfare of the country.
Well, it's said now that the current tax rate is the lowest it's been since the 50s. Is that true?
It is quite low. In general, the number of brackets that we have and the rates that are paid in each of those brackets are quite low by historical standards now. Now, plenty of Republicans think that they're much too high still, and it is possible to imagine a system which had even lower rates. In 1986, when they did the big Tax Reform Act, the top rate was 28%, and that was a revenue-neutral tax reform. So if you get rid of enough of these special provisions, these special loopholes, you can lower the rates a lot, and that's pretty much good for everybody. That's why tax reform worked in '86, is because the Democrats liked the idea of getting rid of loopholes, which primarily benefited rich people, and Republicans liked the idea of lowering the rates. It was a happy agreement. It just didn't last.
Well, one of the arguments being given now for not imposing a new tax on the richest people is that it would cut down on job growth. But haven't they enjoyed lower taxes since the Bush cuts? And here we are with the highest levels of unemployment we've seen in a very long time, since the Depression.
Yeah, I think that's the flip side of what I was saying before. High taxes don't necessarily get in the way of growth, and low taxes don't necessarily guarantee you will get growth. Other things are more important. And I think it's a pretty reasonable argument to be made on, from liberals, you'll hear this a lot, which is that the growing concentration of wealth at the top of the income scale is hampering our economic health, is harming our economic health, because people don't have the money to spend and it slows the whole economy, and that an economy will just do better and grow better if wealth is more evenly distributed.
Let's read some of the comments that our listeners have been writing in. Amy left this question on our show page. Jerry Brown advocated a flat tax when he was running for president. Was it considered a left-wing idea at the time? And if so, how did it become a right-wing one?
Well, I think, again, there is a sort of inherently appealing quality to a flat tax that I think some conservatives generally tend to like quite a bit, but even many liberals can get on board for, too, because there's this sense that the system right now, it may have progressive rates, but it doesn't work the way it's supposed to work. It's got too much favoritism going on in it. It's got too many loopholes in it. And there's this thought that if we could clean it up and get everybody to at least pay something reasonable all together at the same level, that sort of appeals to the kind of we're all in it together spirit. So I don't think the flat tax is inherently horrible to people on the left, although in general I think liberals prefer to have a progressive rate structure. So yeah, that was a little quirky, I gotta say, for Governor Brown to support it. But he's not the only one. There are plenty of Democrats out there who are at least willing to talk about this.
Tom in California asks, the national sales tax might be a reasonable alternative to the current federal tax system. Can it be structured to ensure progressivity and also spur economic growth, like a prebate to provide money to cover for food and other necessary expenses?
Yeah, it's definitely possible, to talk more broadly about consumption taxes, whether that's a sales tax that we collect at the cash register or a value-added tax that's collected from businesses while they're producing things. These things tend to be more regressive, but there are ways to fix that, like these prebates that they talk about for that national sales tax. What that tends to do is it makes the tax more progressive on the low end. It lets people who are sort of struggling pay less, and that's good. It also tends to let rich people reduce their taxes quite a bit, which a lot of liberals are uncomfortable with. So I think that, yes, and I think most economists will endorse the idea that a consumption tax is, on balance, probably a little better for the economy, and you can make it more progressive, and there are some very compelling proposals out there for progressive consumption taxes. That's not to say that what we're seeing from the Republican candidates bear any resemblance to that sort of progressive consumption tax.
Let's take a call. Our caller is Derek from Manhattan. Hi, Derek. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I think the initial statement about history of taxes missed an important key point that's relevant to today's talk about flat taxes, and that is most of the issues that were described had to do with the sophistication and the increased cost of war, which is why the monarchs or the political regimes had to raise significant taxes, including conscription and food to feed the army, money to pay for the army, and freestanding armies. that relates to today's issue that the Republican campaign pushes the flat tax as broadening the base. What they want to do in broadening the base is, A, increase taxes on the poor, and B, decrease taxes on the rich, which decreasing taxes on the rich hasn't worked, as you rightfully pointed out here recently, that we've had that since the Reagan tax cuts, going on to the Bush tax cuts, and that's only increased the wealth of the rich. The 47 million people who don't pay federal income taxes don't pay because they're poor and can't afford to pay them.
You want to respond?
I think I'd endorse almost all of that. I just want to jump down onto the war thing. I actually did a book called War and Taxes and essentially argue that the history of the U.S. tax system is essentially a history of war and taxes, because it's the wars in American history that have made for big changes in the way we tax ourselves. So, you know, our modern tax system is a relic of World War II, and the income tax, the one we have today, had its origins more or less in World War I, and then there was an income tax in the Civil War. So it's these wars that make legislators creative about how to tax, and in general, they've also just sort of raised money, more money, over time. Wars get expensive, and the taxes tend not to fall back completely afterwards.
Derek, thank you so much for your call. Ed left this comment. He said, I live on Long Island, and we have a sales tax of 8.5%. Under the 999 plan, would we still have to pay this local sales tax? If so, that would effectively make it a 999 8.5 flat tax, almost 40%.
Yeah, well, it's true now as well that we pay our federal taxes, but we also have to pay our state and local taxes too. And there's nothing that's going to change about that. Whatever reforms we might decide to adopt at the federal level, we're still going to be paying our state taxes too. It might complicate how we pay our state taxes. It might be pretty hard to collect a lot of sales taxes at once. But we're still going to face all of that.
Steve has this question. He said, I love the idea of a flat tax until I discovered the fair tax. Is Mr. Thorndike familiar with this plan, and would you care to comment on it?
Well, that's a retail sales tax for the federal level. And, I'm not inherently opposed to the idea of a consumption tax if it could be done right. My concerns about the fair tax are mostly administrative. I think it would be very hard to pull off on a practical level because the rates would have to be reasonably high, really quite high. There's a lot of debate about exactly how high, but somewhere between, like, say, 20 and 30%. And when you start taxing like that at the retail level, there's a really big incentive for evasion. There's a big incentive for people to start selling their stereo systems off the back of the truck, right? Because then they can avoid that tax. You know, that's obviously dangerous. It's illegal. But as the rate goes up, there's more and more incentive to do that. You know, people will say there's more and more incentive to cheat on your income taxes as rates go up, and that's true. But I think that the sales tax is particularly prone to that. So my worries about that tax are primarily administrative, not so much about fairness.
Eddie from Englewood asks, is it true that General Electric didn't have to pay any income tax in the past year? And why is that?
I'm not sure about General Electric for the past year, but I am sure that many companies did not pay any income tax last year, and many large ones. Corporate taxes are very complicated, especially in a global marketplace, and companies are able to reduce their tax bills in a variety of different ways. It's routine. So our top corporate tax rate is 35%, but some companies pay quite a bit, not 35%, but say like in the 20s, mid-20s, high 20s even. But many, many companies, especially those in which it's easy to shift things overseas, to shift operations overseas, to shift assets overseas, they pay much, much lower rates. There are real problems with the corporate income tax in a global economy, and we haven't really figured it out. So it's clearly a broken tax right now. In my view, I would get rid of it entirely, and not as a favor to corporations. I would rather collect that money in a different way from shareholders if it were possible.
And the president has been quoting Warren Buffett's line about paying at a lower rate than his secretary. That's something that has been resonating.
Well, and that it gets to the issue which we haven't mentioned, and it's relevant to the flat tax, which is how it treats capital income. And when we say capital income, what we usually mean most of the time is a capital gain on the sale of an asset, or interest income, or dividend income, or something like that. In general, those sorts of income are all treated favorably under the current tax system. So that's why Warren Buffett pays such low taxes, because most of his income comes in the form of a capital gain or an interest or dividends, and so that's not taxed at our regular progressive rate structure. To encourage investment, which maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. I think the jury is not clearly decided on that. The economists will continue to debate that. But what is clear is that it means he gets a much lower average tax rate than he would if we didn't offer those preferences. Now, a lot of these flat tax proposals, including the one from Governor Perry and the one from Herman Cain, they would not tax capital income at all. They would get rid of the capital gains tax. They would exempt interest and dividend income from taxes. There are economic arguments about why that might be okay, that income is already being taxed at a different level, like on the corporate level, although I don't happen to agree with that. But the reality of that is that if you stop taxing those at all, Warren Buffett's going to pay a lot less than he's paying even right now. So I think that's usually what hangs up the flat tax, is that people like the idea, let's get rid of the loopholes and let's lower the rates. And then they say, wait a minute, we're not going to tax capital gains, so these guys are going to get away with murder. It's probably not murder. There's a credible argument for it, but I think it just doesn't meet the basic fairness test.
Stuart from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Calling about the alternative minimum tax, which was originally enacted to get rich people who have offshore investments and that thing to pay more tax because they were hiding it. However, more and more middle-class people are ending up paying it now, and the alternative minimum tax has never been adjusted for the geographic location of where the taxpayer lives, and since it costs more to live in New York City than it does in the rest of the country for housing, rent, food, transportation, etc., more and more we get paid more living here, but our expenses are so much higher, but yet more and more of us are paying the alternative minimum tax. Other than moving to another part of the country, how do we resolve this inequity?
Well, the alternative minimum tax is not a proud moment in the history of American tax policy. I think that tax was designed to do, as you say, it was designed to make sure that rich people weren't getting away with murder. But the way that they actually enacted it, they allowed inflation to push people up into it over time, and it's now become a middle-class tax. It was never meant to be that way. So Congress, every year or every couple of years, scrambles around and exempts all of the middle-class people that they think should be exempted from it. It's a very expensive little temporary fix, but they don't fix the problem in any permanent way because it's too expensive. We're sort of addicted to the money that tax brings in on some level. It's really not good. This tax is doing things it was never meant to do. It really should be gotten rid of entirely, but Congress can't afford to do that. It's because of the way the budget rules work, it would be just too expensive, and they have no way to pay for it.
We have very little time, but a listener wants to know what countries do have flat taxes. You said that it works in some places.
I'm not sure how many of them still have it, but I think that most of them do. But lots of Eastern European countries have flat taxes. After the fall of communism, these countries, a lot of them looked around and said, "Well, what could we do?" What could we do to raise money and to attract business investment? And they decided a flat tax was a way to do that.
Thank you so much. Joseph Thorndike is director of the Tax History Project at Tax Analysts, a nonprofit, nonpartisan provider of tax news and analysis. It's been a real pleasure having you on today's Please Explain segment.
Oh, it was my pleasure to be here.